but humanity is a subcategory of the great apes, and we're animals. You went all over the place. Panspermia is an interesting theory that's been that has not been proven in the slightest. I alluded to it earlier when Paul mentioned the possibility of finding amino acids in heavenly bodies, and that doesn't necessarily mean life. It just means organic chemistry that would be suitable for the development of life. How life began on this world is a big question. I think the major researchers tend to believe that it began in a kind of organic soup in a pool of water with some lightning and UV light and such, creating interesting organic chemistry that was capable of becoming self-replicating. And over millions, if not a billion years, was able to fine-tune itself to be consistently replicating and such. If there are viruses in outer space, there pretty much kind of needs to be single-celled organisms, because viruses don't really exist in a vacuum, if you will, by itself. Viruses cannot replicate without a non-virus cell host. So finding a space virus would suggest you would find space cells, and you might find organized space cells. There might be a space animal or a space person or a space humanoid or what have you. But all of this, unfortunately, is conjecture. We have no indication whatsoever that no one has seen anything that suggests a virus or a bacteria or a alien, a 5-foot-tall, green-skinned alien wandering around with a probe. So I think I addressed a few of your points. I think, Paul, wanted to ask you the constituents of the ice on Mars. I think, it's not like they actually sat down and did significant studies. They basically are basing their knowledge on reflection and different kind of physical ways of imaging reflections off of something and absorption at different frequencies of electromagnetic waves. But if you have something to add about this, Paul, please feel free.
Yeah, okay. Well, with the 6 spacecraft that landed on Mars, was actually 7 now, successfully, 4 of them, five of them were rovers, and they've done studies, and one of the things they're looking for is ice. And there was one spacecraft that landed in the northern hemisphere of Mars, and that was called a Phoenix mission. And one day they scraped the dirt with the, they had a robotic arm, and they scraped the dirt, and they were analyzing the dirt here and there. And at one spot they noticed it was like white looking, and they determined eventually that was ice. And the way they figured that out is they took a picture of it like the next day, and it was gone, and it scintillated, it just literally evaporates. It goes from an ice form to a gaseous form, and it disappeared. It was only a little piece of, and you can see pictures of it. To this day, you can bring up NASA, Phoenix, and ice on Mars, and I'm sure you'll see it. And then they have before and after pictures. You click back and forth. So they know it's there. They can't dig it out yet and really analyze it. They do have equipment on board the rovers that analyze a lot of stuff. But if a scientist wanted to really analyze something, whether it be solid ground or ice from Mars, they would like to get it back home. And I don't think any of the samples that are due to come home from Mars contain ice, but you know, maybe there might be some frozen thing in there that eventually that they'll look at. You know, a lot of people say, well, why don't they just send more test equipment, you know, to Mars? They say the test equipment that they really need to analyze everything would be, you know, gigantic, heavy things. You couldn't afford to send anything like that to Mars to analyze the stuff. We have good techniques with what we have on Mars, but not what they really need. So someday when they get those samples home, they'll definitely know more by putting this into a real heavy duty analyzing equipment, and then we'll know. But for now, they don't know. And the same with the moon. The same thing with those. They know that there's ice in those craters. Someday they'll dig it out and they'll analyze the heck out of it. Back to you, Roy. WS2S.
Hey, ETPL, clear.
Yes, Jeff.
I was curious. Conversation. Thank you, Roy, for picking me up. I just had a couple questions. One, virus or bacteria, amino acid or organized amino acid. First of all, it would have to get into space somehow to be an ice blob that was traveling through space. So how would it get into space? How would it have first survived that transition from whatever celestial body it was to get into space? Second, upon freezing, and freezing, probably instantaneous freezing, would there not be damage to any virus or bacteria or anything like that? We do that all the time in the lab, and we need to add something that cryoprotects samples. And then upon reentry into any other body where supposedly you're transposing a new life form or kind of proto-organelle, I really could not even imagine the statistical possibility for any of these happening over any eon, any period of time. It's just absurd. Second question is, the term for going from a solid to a gas, of course, is sublimation. And finally, the question that has been just sitting in the back of my head when we talk about all this stuff is, how did chirality of our life arise here on the planet or deep in space, right?
Okay, you brought up a couple of interesting aspects of how does this stuff get into deep space. If you want to play what if, I could theoretically see, large bodies in space collide with other large bodies in space, gravity being gravity. And, like when the proto-Earth that collided with us and left us the moon, there's a case of exchanging mass, not in the most secure, safe way, but there's ways of splattering bits and pieces of a planet into outer space. Will most of the organic material, living things, if there are such things as living things, survive it? Probably not, but maybe some might. Again, I'm not a big fan of panspermia, but it is a reasonable theory. As far as chirality, I would assume it was sort of a random situation. The early molecules that tended to work were either dextrorotatory or levorotatory, and they reproduced similar chirality on and on and on, in the same way that DNA is probably a very early design, because it seems to have seeped into everything in RNA viruses, DNA viruses, and bacteria and cells. So I don't have that much of a problem with chirality.
All right. I mean, I can see some random event tipping the chiral scale 51 to 49, or even some you know, some fraction even smaller than that, and eventually over billions of years winding up selecting for the right-handed helix. But I don't think that some exploding planet somewhere else, which was instantaneously frozen, transported over, you know, light years distance, and then somehow managed to survive reentry here. I think statistically it's just absurd. Anyway, that's an opinion. It's not based in science, but having frozen and thawed many biological samples with varying degrees of success, I just can't even imagine the possibilities. Right. AC2 Gil, thanks for picking me up. Excellent.
Wesley recognized. I'll get to you in a second. I just want to say that, you know, I mean, the idea of why nature randomly picked a certain chirality kind of mimics the problem that physicists have with matter-antimatter. If you go back a little bit past the Big Bang, all that energy was turning into matter-antimatter particles. And still, about 98% of the mass energy of the universe is in photons. A very small percentage was left behind as protons and basically hydrogen and a little bit of helium atoms before suns did their things and produced heavier objects. But, you know, you kind of stuck with a similar type of a problem. Where did all the antimatter go? People posited all kinds of interesting things, that there were galaxies that were made out of antimatter or galaxies made out of matter. Looking around, it doesn't seem to make any sense. So there seems to be an inherent asymmetry in the very nature of physics when it comes to the creating atoms or protons or neutrons or what have you out of nothingness. So, you know, I think it's easier to believe in just the happenstance of certain chiralities somehow surviving and replicating themselves. And it may not be universal. I don't think it is. One of the things that I always kind of thought in the back of my head would be an interesting science fiction story is where a bunch of guys land on a planet, and they're rather stupid, and they see all this food and stuff, and they don't quite understand why it makes the animals sick and die. It's because the sugars and everything else are the wrong chirality. So I thought it would have made a nice kind of Isaac Asimovish short story. It's a little too much hard science for these days, unfortunately.
That's an awesome idea, AC2PL. Feynman actually proved that a positron is exactly the same as an electron traveling backwards in time. So I would posit that it's equally probable that all the positrons at the Big Bang headed in a different direction in time than the electrons. Just a thought.
Yeah, I've seen that, and it's a clever way of interpreting the mathematics, because mathematics can lead you down strange places. If you insert an imaginary number for the mass, you get tachyons, which are completely theoretical. I think a lot of physicists don't really agree with the idea that antimatter is matter going in the opposite timeline, because the antimatter decays in the same timeline that matter decays. So you would think it would have a much stranger decay if it was actually traveling back in time. So although it sounds nice, and matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago I was watching YouTube, and one of the major channels made a faux pas and said that antimatter had negative mass, which it doesn't. If you look it up anyplace, antimatter and matter have positive mass. Gravity works the same way. They did a recent experiment on antimatter, and antimatter works the same as matter gravitationally. So although it sounds nice, and I understand the underlying mathematics that Feynman used to make that charming kind of interesting description. I think it's purely happenstance. I don't think it's a real thing. I think positrons are traveling forward in time with us like the rest of things.
That makes it much easier to wrap my head around. Anyway, Roy, thanks for picking me up, and always entertaining. AC2PL, back to next.
You're welcome. Yes, Wesley, I just wanted to tell Jeff that he's welcome, and thanks for participating. But on to you, Wesley.
Yeah, Jeff is extremely editive. I do appreciate comments very much. Sorry about that. I was away for the moment, so... first little comment. Single photon cannot produce electron-positron pair. So, and they don't have a vector. In other words, in order to eventually set it as go back in time or go for the positron, go in different way, you need to have a vector. And that's a problem. Another thing is I was away for a moment and I didn't hear. Is it possible that ice in Mars could have a frozen any form of life? And is it possible that ice that eventually at any time could travel through the space was able to bring some form of life into another planet? Doesn't have to be Earth, but to you.
Well, you know, earlier we kind of talked about that, and Jeff is not happy with that idea. The amount of cataclysmal efforts necessary to do that, he thinks, would vaporize, atomize, or what have you, any specimen possible. The reality is, can space ice have organic molecules? Can it have viruses? Can it have bacteria? Can it have some ancient alien thumb frozen in it? Yes, it can. Does it? Is there any indication? Is there any reason to think so? Not really. Just guys who dream. And again, we know very, very little about space ice. We've detected, we got pictures of it. That's about all we got. So there's no idea if what's dissolved in the ice before it froze. Is it pure water ice? Is it salty ice? Does it have other things dissolved in it? Does it have organic molecules dissolved in it? No one has a clue. Okay, you could write a book, you could write an article, and you could say, what if? But that's not my idea of science. That's my idea of speculative science / fiction, personally. So, although it would be nice, it would be exciting, it would be something new, I wouldn't bet my last buck on that one.
Hey, it's a real quick comment.
Yes, sure, Jeff.
Carl Sagan, while he was at Cornell, he used to pursue these things and do the primordial soup experiments. I'm sure you're well aware of this, Roy. My lab overlooked the astrophysics building. I was in Olin Lab in the chemistry department at Cornell and was concurrent with some of the research going on there. And they used to do those experiments and put all sorts of oddball organic chemicals into a giant glass flask and bung a spark through it and see what happens. And there was a profound explosion one day. They blew up the entire lab, and there was just smoke pouring out the window of that lab. No one was hurt, fortunately, but I was there to witness that. So there are consequences to such kind of fanciful ideas. AC2PO, back to that.
Well, that's the story of chemistry. I mean, anyone involved in chemistry long enough has either had an experiment go terribly, terribly wrong, or knew a friend who had one go terribly, terribly wrong. That's the beauty of mathematics. The worst they could get is give you a headache. It couldn't blow off a piece of your anatomy.
God save us. I've survived two lab explosions during my PhD, and that's why I got into biology. Far fewer explosions. AC2PL. sorry to interrupt, Wes.
And WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I see they still have that site up with the Phoenix lander that NASA sent to Mars. And it, sure enough, they do show the same pictures of ice, and then the ice is gone, and then, you know, the sublimation of it just made it disappear. They talk about it. But they still have it. It's jpl.nasa.gov/news/bright-chunks@phoenix-lander-mars-site. Must have been ice. And then, you know, you could put that long thing in, or you could just put in, you know, Phoenix ice sublimation, or, and I'm sure, you know, when you put in Phoenix spacecraft. And sure enough, they show it. It was nice and shiny, and it all went away. But boy, would the scientists love to, you know, put a core borer into that thing and bring it home and analyze, you know, every molecule that was that would be inside that piece of ice. The size of a, they said the size of a dice, you know, quite small. But that was the first sign I really saw of any picture of, you know, pure ice on Mars. Back to you, Rory. WS2N.
Yeah, I'm looking at the at some of the images on Google, AC2GS, by the way. Yeah, I just recently saw a YouTube video that was promoting the worldwide assault on going back to the moon. And their point of view pretty much was that the discovery of ice deposits kind of gave people the inclination that you could do a lot with that. If it's sitting there on the moon, you don't have to bring it there. Although I don't know how easy it is to extract and you know, what you would have to go through to extract it. So it might be cheaper and easier to just bring your own water. But that seems to be one of the big motivating forces. They're thinking about they could break it apart and turn it into hydrogen-based rocket fuel. They could break the other part apart and turn it into oxygen so that astronauts can breathe. So they're very fascinated and obsessed with the discovery of water. But, you know, I think people are going to be disappointed if they think they're going to find a fish or something frozen in there. I don't think you'll find anything. If we're very, very, very lucky, we'll find some dissolved organic chemistry going on, which, you know, you shouldn't really allude to. Well, obviously that was made by a living thing, because not living things, as Jeff will tell you. And Dick used to repeat that story about those guys putting lightning arcs into beakers full of marsh waters and such, and then testing them for amino acids and all kinds of organic chemistry. So, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath. I don't think the small ice deposits we're going to find are going to prove extraterrestrial life. It might prove a degree of extraterrestrial organic chemistry, which I think most people kind of believe exists, just in the nature of the universe, but whether or not they're related to life, that's a whole different thing entirely.
I think that experiment Jeff was talking about, it was called Thorin or Thorlin. They gave it a name, and that's in Carl Sagan's, a couple of Carl Sagan's books. I believe it's in the Pale Blue Dot book. Whole story about that. Back to you, Ross.
Wesley, are you out there?
Yes, I am, but Paul gave the microphone to you, so I was addressed. That's why I was silent. Okay. So, I know it's a time for space report, but shortly, because we're not going to go to that nonsense. We have I know it is going to be difficult. My stable oxygenating metamaterials, just a few words and eventually link to the video, because this is interesting you could give. And then there was a PhD with NASA trying to the Galileo probe project. That's the criticism. So, joint NASA study evaluated that the current global energy platform operates only at two forms of energy, alternating current AC and direct current DC. Those two forms were invented over 135 years ago by Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, and now AZO Materials Company says that they have a breakthrough, which is actually AC with DC offset, nothing special, no gain. If you can say a few words and we go to the next one and finish up that subject. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a bunch of grifters. It isn't AZO. AZO was simply republishing directly from, what was it called? ADC Energy. So if you look at the very bottom, it said reprint from ADCEnergy.com, which is the company that's doing research and development and trying to get investors to give them money on make-believe technology. Not that it's make-believe technology, but it's DC biased alternating current, which is kind of ancient. We talked about the concept. It goes back to the early 1900s, and there's nothing magical, and it's not going to do anything that the CEO ADC Energy Incorporated says it is. I found a YouTube of his making outlandish promises based on nonsense speak. He doesn't have a PhD. He doesn't have a master's. He doesn't have a bachelor's in any science. He's a lawyer. So you got a lawyer who's trying to kind of crank up some investment banker equity fund to give him a lot of money to waste and pocket. So it's a grift.
Okay. And a few words about the Galileo project, but I think more than five words is even too much. Back to you.
I don't know what you're alluding to right now.
Yeah, the Galileo project that is referred to the aliens and it refers to the NASA revelation whatsoever. It's about Avi Loeb, Professor Avi Loeb. About aliens stations and whatsoever. That actually came across NASA releasing some video material about some unrecognized object.
AC2GS. Yeah, I have no respect for Avi Loeb. If I was part of a university that granted him a PhD, I would probably find a good reason to pull it. He publishes books on little green men. He has nothing to base any of this on. He has taken a legitimate degree from a legitimate university and turned it into somewhat of a farce by being obsessed about little green men. But, you know, when that kind of very weird Oumuamua asteroid was wobbling in space, rather than to come out with any kind of a reasonable reason why it was making the strange movements, apparently because it was lighter than it looked, and evaporation of ice produced some propellant action. And he said that it was probably a spaceship. So I discount just about everything Avi Loeb says and is and does and writes. Aside from that, I'm sure he's been very nice to his mommy.
Okay, so the next one would be RoboFarming. I don't know if you had a chance. It's just a few words because it's kind of unique thing. And I can say a few words about it, but I believe you can do it much better. Back to you.
Okay. I mean, basically, it was an interesting YouTube, but it's better seen than described. What they do is they form either sheets of metal or preformed metal surfaces. They have two robots with sensors on their probes, opposing on opposite sides of the sheet or whatever the material is. One pushes, the other pushes back, and they slowly kind of form it like they're working in clay, if you will, with a lot of heavy force on the robotic arms into interesting accurate shapes. So they take something that started as either a complete flat surface or a curved surface, and they poke it on both ends until they shape it and fold it and form it into a different surface contour.
Yes, actually, it's a robotic incremental sheet forming, and it allows to generate 3D geometry form into the two-dimensional metal sheet directly from design data. Like you have two fingers opposite and a piece of rubber in between. So it means you have vertically piece of rubber, or actually not rubber, some sort of material, and you put one finger from one side and second finger from the other side, but actually you have a slight offset, very slight offset. So when you remove your fingers, that bend, that deformation actually remains. The next thing I believe is bistable auxetics metamaterial. Dr. Roy, I don't know how to properly pronounce that. It's BAM. It's a class of monolithic perforated periodic structures with negative Poisson ratio. So under tension, that material can expand and reach a second state of equilibrium through the globally large shape transformation. In other words, in a simple form, when you have a piece of rubber and you pull it with two hands, with your fingers, it becomes thinner in the middle. It's, let's say, bubble gum. But this material actually grows up in three dimensions when you try to pull it. It could actually even be done this way, that you pull it from the left and the right hand side, but it expands in 90 degrees dimension, the right angle dimension towards the vector of pulling. Dr. Roy, say more. Enter.
Okay, as I pointed out in an email, this is pretty much impossible to discuss on a radio. It isn't actually that the dimensions grow bigger for the solid object. It's that a lot of empty space kind of fills up a lot of the parts making it up, so that there are now gaps and spaces that end up having the height, the width and the depth both increased by exerting force across one axis. And of course, do you want to mention something that has a zero Poisson index?
Material says negative, not zero, negative Poisson ratio. So under tension, BAM can expand and reach a second state of equilibrium through the globally large shape transformation that is ensured by the flexibility of its elastomeric base material. So I'm kind of not totally agreeing with you because we're talking about the elastomers. Back to you.
No, what I'm getting at is the YouTube visually demonstrated something with a zero Poisson index. I just wondered if you recalled it.
Yes, I do, but I'm talking about the properties of the material used. Actually, what I did is they used the press to make the spaces and allow the material to expand in three dimensions, at least 2D, whichever. No, actually, three dimensions. So you could actually have a material lying on the table, but if you flip it, it may actually form the women bra. Okay, and it stays in this form when you gently put it on the table. But vice table, if you go to durable vice table auxetics material or made of rigid solids, durable vice table auxetics made of rigid solids, you're going to find more about elastomers. Back to you.
Okay, we each find fascinating things ourselves. Personally, I thought that this the very short discussion that cork has a Poisson index of zero, and thus it does not change dimensionally when you apply force on it, which allows you to use it as the stopper of wine bottles, is both fascinating and incredibly useful. So a Poisson zero index material has had use over thousands of years, whereas the rest of the stuff, which I guess you can generate on a sophisticated 3D printer and such, and has interesting topology, I don't think people are going to be making bras out of the stuff anytime too soon, or domes or anything like that, but it certainly is interesting, especially on YouTube videos. But I must say that I was much more interested in the cork.
I understand that, but I'm actually pointing at more than just a video. I'm talking about negative Poisson ratio and the material that I was relating to doesn't have to be 3D printed or press stamped in order to be able to expand. For the bra, it would be kind of a very much modern form or modern style, because it's kind of perforated. And when you make a bra from it, it's even more perforated in certain places. So, yeah, interesting. Back to you.
Beta Cristobalet.
Yes.
Beta Cristobalet, average Poisson ratio of minus 0.16.
Okay.
I can't imagine wearing a bra made of that, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you saw...
you have to look at the video. Dr. Roy may send you the link.
Yeah, if you saw the video, you would kind of appreciate it. It's not really a bra. It's a topological structure that has two domes next to each other. So, you know, if you want to think of it that way, fine. But I would imagine it offers nothing in the ways of support or anything else. It's just, it's different topologies to an interesting geometry that was discussed on the YouTube, as they've done about the bistable structures that you can 3D print, and I did a few of those. I one of the many things that I showed at some of the hamfests were bimode plastic. If you can have a little bit of flexibility in it, it locks in two different positions, a lot like the general light switch does. So it's the topology, I think, that counts. I don't think that it was presented as a solution to the never-ending bra problem.
Okay.
By the way, okay, you weren't on the radio for 2 weeks, Dr. Roy, so I didn't have a chance to wish you Happy New Year. Is it ending with 84 right now? The word is quite old. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, yeah, I believe it's 5784 right now. And yeah, well, it's a lot older than that, but you know, our ancestors didn't have anything to base anything on, so they did their best guess. And gee, it would have completely confused them if you started to talk about billions of years old for the old planet.
Oh yeah, definitely, I agree with you. I think that's all for tonight from me. We were, there is something, just a few words, W1VLF. W1VLF, the guy is, has a YouTube channel, and I'm quite into VLF, which his call sign is VLF, and I found pretty interesting stuff in it. Dr. Roy wasn't impressed so much, but in one of the videos, he used the one bigger antenna that was 3 lambda. So imagine that you have a rhombic antenna for 2 meters, but he used 2 or 3 lambda for the arms of it. So 2 or 3 wavelengths, whichever one you want to experiment with, and in order for that to have a lobe in the right place, you need to put the resistor at one end of the rhombic. I believe Dr. Roy was kind enough to look at all of the videos that I have asked him to send. Let me jump. And he probably didn't mention, didn't notice that, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I noticed. I don't think he's specializing in very low frequency. I think that's just the way his call sign went, but I could be totally wrong. I don't have the faintest idea, but, you know, the guy who features a 2-meter antenna doesn't strike me as a person who's particularly focused on very low frequencies. And why, you know, I mean, one of the benefits of operating on 2 meters is that you can do it with a small, a compact antenna. Why the heck you would decide to screw around with something enormous like a rhombic for 2 meters strikes me as bizarre. You want to be directional? Fine, get a Yagi. It's smaller than the rhombic. So you know, I think ultimately, not that I would probably ask this guy, but if I asked this guy, why the hell did you decide to use a rhombic for 2 meters? He said, well, he would probably say something along the ways of why not. So I wasn't terribly impressed. He used a noise reduction comparator that we've talked about many times in the past to invert the signal of a local AM broadcast and silence it to a degree. So, you know, so they've been around for 30 years. I mean, good old Rich, W2BZ, was very deeply interested recently in a modern design for something that could phase adjusted based on a secondary antenna to lower the noise. And I think when he heard the noise being slightly lowered, but not much, he was remarkably unimpressed, as I was when I saw this particular video. There's a lot of ham videos. Some of them are wonderful, and a lot of them are mediocre, and a few of them are god-awful. The one thing that I cannot forgive hams who do YouTubes and videos is they should care about their audio. But I have had more than a few of these guys who apparently use the zoom lens and use the camera microphone, because it sounds like they're talking through a very, very, very long toilet core roll. This guy kind of, he's not bad, he's not awful, he's not saying wrong things, but he's not telling me anything that I didn't already know 10 years ago, and I don't know. He didn't impress me personally, but his job is not to impress me, I'm sure.
Well, because I'm into VLF, then I could view a few of his videos. I found interesting stuff in it. And actually, you're absolutely right. Why not? He actually mentioned that you could use the Yagi antenna, but why not? Nobody does it. Why not? Why not to use the Rumpic antenna? You cannot use it for HI because it's humongous. Most of the people do not have enough of real estate for that, but why not? So, it's not about discovery, it's about activity. So the guy is active, and he likes it. Apart from that, he has quite nice land that allows him to experiment. And to HGS.
AC2GS? Okay, I'm happy for him. He has land, and he likes doing what he's doing. And, you know, I mean, there's a difference between making YouTubes that are informative versus entertaining. This is kind of just making it for the sake of making it. This is a guy who's just kind of, I might be completely wrong, but this kind of, I get the vibes that he wanted to make a YouTube, so he said, what the hell, no one else is doing it. You know, I mean, no one else is sticking their head in the toilet bowl and holding their breath. That doesn't necessarily mean I want to watch a YouTube of someone doing it. So, okay, yeah, that's true. No one else, I'm sure, you know, if you Google YouTube, you're probably not going to find anyone putting up that type of antenna for 2 meters. You'll have them doing it for 20, but you're not going to have them doing it for 2, because it's kind of foolish. So, you want to watch someone do something that's sort of foolish, or has nothing better to do, then yeah. But, I don't know, my life, you know, I treasure every moment of my life. Watching him do that kind of thing, I'm never going to get those minutes back.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. I appreciate that I can find some place when I'm feeding you into your free time. And you're kind enough to read my emails. I believe it's the time for Space Report and to exchange.
Well, I think your clock's a little fast. I got 9:58, usually around 10:15. We'll see what happens. If no one has anything else, we can zip over to that. But I thank you for participating, and I wish you a happy, a healthy New Year. And everyone else out there, most of the high holidays have come and gone. We still have Sukkot, but Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur have come and gone, and I wish you all a happy, healthy New Year. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So we do have a few more minutes if someone wants to use them. If you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call number.
Hi, I'm Charlie, AJU. I'd like to say goodnight, and this was interesting. I listened to it all.
Okay, very good, Charlie. I'm glad you enjoyed it. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., last 2 weeks I took off. I don't think I've ever taken 2 weeks in a row off just because of the Jewish holidays being the way they were. But we'll be back here next Sunday at 8 p.m. to do it all over again. So be well, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Have a happy holiday.
Anyone more? Anyone with a question?
Yes, good old YDY. What can I do you for?
Well, I'm just wondering if anybody's got any advice on how to repair a Larson 270 base. I have one that's opened up. There's no contact or no continuity between any of the base, the NMO base, and the antenna. I'm just trying to figure out if there's any way to repair this thing before I drop it in the garbage.
Okay, who manufactures it?
It's a Larson. The Larson 2-70B, I believe it is.
Okay, anyone have any expertise out there they'd like to share with us? Well,
all right, well, thank you anyway. I guess I'll just try a little bit of brute force and see what I find when I open it up.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, if all else fails, you know, bang on it a bunch of times. I mean, in the old days before the surface-mounted design, that was always a very good first method of fixing anything. There's always going to be some loose contact someplace that occasionally you could bang into life again. There's certainly, MFJ stuff reeked of bad contacts.
W2BZ.
Ah, Rich, I alluded to you earlier when Wesley brought out the phase reduction noise device that some guy wasted, I think it was 20 minutes of YouTube on.
Yes, I heard that. Most of the YouTube, you're right. Some of the YouTubes are fabulous, some are okay, and some are sort of horrible. But as you know, I've really taken a deep dive into Microsoft Flight Simulator, and there are some great, great YouTubes about some of the more intricate parts of flying. I mean, I can't imagine learning Microsoft Flight Simulator without these YouTubes. So YouTube has become the video encyclopedia of the world. Anyway, my question is, how do they calculate the takeoff angle of an antenna? I always questioned how they came up with that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of different ways. You can do it theoretically. If you have a good antenna simulation software and you've modeled it correctly, it will give you a reasonable estimate. In practical terms, the best way to do it is in an anechoic chamber with a field strength meter and a ladder. In the military, that's what they do. They know exactly the takeoff angle of every radiating antenna on every piece of plane equipment that they buy for billions of dollars. So, as my understanding, it's primarily a practical knowledge. There's theory behind it, but there's practical measurements to back it up.
So they're actually measuring what angle the energy is coming off the antenna?
KC2G, yes. Well, they don't do that for every antenna. I mean, they did it for the military and electrical engineers who had a lot of money to spend doing research, did fundamental studies on different types of antennas. And so if you present an electrical engineer with a 5/8 wave vertical, he has the rough approximation of what the radiation pattern looks like. Nowadays, we rely a lot more on antenna simulators that have that built into them. So a lot of times, guys will just show you the model simulated with the radiation patterns in three-dimensional space demonstrating the takeoff angle. But, you know, it's rooted in practical reality, a lot like the way that people figured out how to measure a half-wave center-fed dipole. Back in the 20s, the ARRL simply built a lot of them, made them resonant, wrote down the numbers, and took an average and, sent out in one of its handbooks, I think, the equation we know so much, you know, using the number 468.
So, you know, there's a horizontal plane and there's a vertical plane. And I think you said the magic word that makes me understand it now, and that those radiation patterns are 3D. So they are, you know, taking into account the horizontal radiation and the vertical radiation. Is that correct?
Yes, it's all important. And nowadays there are a lot of very decent 3D simulation, antenna simulation software can present you with only a horizontal curve and a vertical curve, but it can also generate a pseudo 3D image where the intensities are a function of color. And matter of fact, in the LIMARC e-log, I wrote a bunch of articles using an antenna simulator where I showed the radiating pattern in pseudo three dimensions. So you can do that. There's no problem with that. And it is a three-dimensional type of thing. It depends upon what you're looking for or what axis is more important to you at the time.
Okay, so what is it about a vertical that has an entirely different takeoff pattern than a dipole? What in its physical nature is so different?
Well, usually a dipole is horizontally oriented, so a 90-degree shift in orientation is going to change a lot of different things, including the interaction with the ground. If you have a vertical, so it's sort of like at its most perfect version, perfect resonance, it's sort of like the radiation pattern is a donut going omnidirectional and up. Whereas if you think about it, if you rotate it 90 degrees, you got some of it going up and being lost. You got others going down and either getting absorbed and reflected. So the way that you orient the radiation pattern of the same type of antenna has a dramatic effect on its performance.
Okay, so the radiation pattern, let's take a vertical. The radiation is coming off of that vertical, both sideways and up and down, and you turn that, like you said, 90 degrees, and you have a dipole or horizontal vertical that the same thing, the radiation is coming off it up and down and sideways, correct?
Well, let's kind of simplify it. If I had a quarter wave ground plane vertical and I had a vertically oriented center-fed dipole, and they were both resonant, they would have very, 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 very similar radiation patterns. The radiation patterns change because of the rotation in the polarization angle, the interaction with the ground, and also if they're multi-band antennas, because at the primary resonant frequency, you get much cleaner radiation patterns. As you go through multiple harmonics, you develop all kinds of complicated nodes. You also get that problem with horizontally polarized antennas that are somewhat close to the ground because you have ground coupling issues. So there's a lot of complicating issues, but fundamentally, in free space, if you had a quarter-wave ground plane antenna and a center-fed dipole antenna, both resonant at that frequency, you probably couldn't tell the difference between the radiation patterns.
Uh-oh, you just opened up a can of worms for me anyway. Are you saying a vertical antenna's takeoff pattern and a horizontally positioned dipole have the same patterns coming off them?
In free space, there's no reference point. What's the meaning of a horizontal antenna, you know, a light year away from us versus a vertical one? What does that mean, even?
Well, I guess that's the question that I've been asking.
Well, it doesn't mean anything. It's relative to Earth ground because Earth ground has such a significant effect on radiation patterns. But if you get away from the Earth and you have these objects in free space, it becomes meaningless. There is no such thing as horizontal or vertical. Horizontal and vertical is based on a reference to the ground. If you don't have a ground, you can't have something in free space just out there someplace and say it's horizontal? Because, again, you need a reference point. It's horizontal to what?
Understood. So it's the ground that's pulling the radiation in certain directions? Is that the concept?
Well, I probably wouldn't use the term pulling, because that gives you a sense of gravity and